Good afternoon, Dr. Dangwere, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is 25, April 2024. We're going to take a break from our discussion of immune cell biochemistry. And I'm going to do this lecture just on epistemology with obviously some weaving of metaphysics. Now, I'm not going to explain why I'm doing that in any elaborate way, except that when one thinks of research science, you have to take into account that it is a network of description of the natural world. That's what the scientific method is doing. But the important word there is research. So we as scientists have developed tools, and those tools are meant to enhance our sensoria, to examine in very deep detail what we imagine is happening, in my case, because I'm a biochemist, in living systems down at the foundational level. And then taking that foundation and bringing it all the way up to the physiological, utilizing molecular genetics and physiology to fill in what is observed at the macro level. Okay. So how we go about doing that should be understood. We should take that into our knowledge base so that when what we believe to be occurring in the living system turns out to be wrong. We made assumptions that were inappropriate. Later on, we found out by doing experiments that should humble us in all of these endeavors that we do in research science. And that for people that aren't scientists, and that's the bulk of the world, even people that practice medicine aren't scientists, they're medical doctors. So those of us that are scientists that teach research science have to add that layer of humility into all the other people that are our students. Otherwise, they don't necessarily get to the level of appreciating that everything we're describing at this deep level of biochemistry, this very fine-grained detail of biochemistry, is essentially using our tools of our sensoria that we put into nature, then we ask questions and pull out the results, and then that becomes what we publish on. So let me give this the detail that it deserves. And if you're not interested in this, then you could just wait until they go back to the regular lectures. And you cannot listen to this lecture at all. And I will never know. So let me just continue. I've made a judgment that space-time as a unified form offers a reasonable synthesis of the extensial. That is, that which is realized to the individual as existing. Okay? So rather than separating space from time, it obviously becomes necessary to agree with logic and experience that both rational forms, that space and time, have to occur simultaneously. Now, I have to be precise because you see in metaphysics, but also in physics and no less in biochemistry, both precision and accuracy are necessary and they must be treated as apodictic when it comes to synthesizing points of view. So living systems pose a unique problem in that they do not require a fixed outcome, except that they all require coming from other living events. and that they must eventually cease to be alive. So living is the essence of existence. And by but existence is not a predicate. It does not appear as a condition or a property of life. It instantiates life via instantiation of our input as human beings to explain what's occurring. So that instantiation is utilizing our free will to put ourselves on a pedestal and say, we're explaining it this way. Okay, that's why I use that word. Okay. So, existence is self-insistent. Now, when courage occurs in an existing individual, what does it do? It discloses that individual for how he lives, and in this way becomes an ontological structure, a real structure that defines the individual's being, and thus it is an existential. However, so that's all well and good at the level of metaphysics up to when I was starting to read it, and then I've changed it a little bit. I sharpen the lens and I replace being, because I see being not as a noun, but as a verb, being. I replace being with simply becoming to allow for the requirement of an event ontology rather than substance ontology worldview. Thus, my new term for existential becomes instantial, reflecting the freely willed, eventuating agency of the ontologically existing individual, the real existence. So the self instantiates his living in time, and the output of his instantial, including any virtue he agentically events is a verb there, into existence. Okay, so instance is the recombination of the energeia with the nous, the Greek terms, and basically that's another way of saying actualization via intellection. We aren't passive observers of nature. We bring our methods into the world to describe the world as we understand it. What is really there cannot be detected by our sensoria, because all the sensoria do is apprehend phenomena. A foundation of this sharpened worldview, which I've proposed now for 3 or 4 years, is that virtues are instantials, potential instantiating actions of the, another term I've come up with, endojective inwardness and ownedness. That's a Heideggerian term, of any individual who freely chooses to be virtuous. Now, why am I bringing in virtue here? Because think about the standard virtues like courage, wisdom, temperance, right? And you might think, well, what does that have to do with biochemistry? Well, it has everything to do with it. Wisdom isn't simply knowledge. Wisdom is an interpretation of knowledge in such a way that brings forward a virtual conclusion. And that virtual conclusion is embedded with human virtue. So it's not virtual in the sense that it's not real. It's virtual in the sense it's a product of the virtue of the intellect trying to understand the world around it. And that's a virtuous process. And in the kind of epistemology I'm trying to describe here. Okay? So it has nothing to do with social structures, is what I'm saying. This whole idea about virtue, using it in this way. Now, virtues do describe social structures, but that's not what I'm talking about here. It has everything to do with personal defining commitment. Now, that is a virtuous way of becoming, right? Personal defining commitments. So, to put it down to a solidified, clear statement, it's virtuous to find the truth. And willing this with your free will requires both courage and wisdom. You have to stick your neck out. You have to put your name with what you're describing. It's the same thing for a research scientist as is for anyone else that is asking others, students, to be compelled to take in what the professor is saying and treat it as not just his point of view or his interpretation of the literature, but his efforts to make it as sound and as close to truth as it is to him as truth. You see? That's very important. So in my view, being courageous is necessary as a research scientist, because it's necessary at a general level, because that's how you become a fully realized human being. However, it's not sufficient. In order to achieve real or ontological full personal realization, one must choose all the virtues. Now, a general discussion of all of that would take a thorough examination of all the non-arbitrary meanings of each virtue instantiale. And I'm actually writing about that, but I'm not lecturing on it. That will appear elsewhere. But for now, I'll leave you with a concept of the instantiale pairing and the requirement for a sudden inbreaking into the world from a previous disequilibria. So living is a disequilibrium. It is a non-steady state perpetuality, becoming uncertain always in the free will driven world, because we know that living is a precarious event. It can end abruptly. Okay? So when I look at the remaining virtues, the obvious instantiale pairing to courage, as I said, is wisdom. So I propose that courage is informed by wisdom. And wisdom is demonstrated through courage. This, in practice, is the pursuit of knowledge, which is justified true belief, if you want a definition for knowledge. So, wisdom is the centered virtue for obtaining truth without the need for fulfilling any obligation to avoid truth, because it does not solve a dialectic. Now, what do I mean by that? The generation of propositions, which are also known as theses, and then counter propositions or antitheses need not end in a erstwhile compromised synthesis. So, what we really need to want to get at is, what is absolute is truth. So you can't be wise if you aren't bold and brave, because there is no eventuality to wisdom without agentic suddenness embodied rather than a long mediation, embodied through courage within the individual. Simultaneously, you're not courageous unless you wisely event, again, uses a verb, your courage already to the world. And when I say already, I think I've described this previous metaphysical lecture. Already means two things to me. Already is that a priori. One is already inclined and at the precipice to deliver this. And already meaning all dash ready to go, to follow through, right? So a priori, and then instantiating, see, already. So courage and wisdom pair out pretty nicely to help cause the world of instance, which is what all of us do whenever we're describing anything we believe and we talk about or we think about. So only the existing individual can create his world where courage obtains and wisdom guides from soul to spirit. The world is not the product of the will. That's something very important for me to say. It is the truth found by obtaining a synthesis only when it can be found by valid and sound conclusions via argumentation, the dialectic. So the conclusions must remain, however, open to perpetual resilience as truths. So if they fail, then you have to abandon that entire coherence of that truth around other truths you think are foundational. Abandon it and then find out what the truth is now. That doesn't mean the truth is new. That means the truth now is the real truth. See? And the truth you thought was in the past, that you've now refuted, for example, by doing research, was never the truth. Say. So that's what the humility comes in. All right. So now back to space time. I don't know how much time I've got here. Oh, yeah, we're doing pretty good. I was first introduced to the concept space time after learning about it in a physics course, probably in high school. When studying Einstein's formulation, normally it's brought up when we're discussing gravity and the curvature of the universe, right? The bending of light. It was only later, though, I'd say much later, that I learned that Immanuel Kant had formulated that particular theory of space-time in his schematization narrative, which is found in his first critique. He wrote three critiques. The first critique. Okay. So I have to put in a however here, or a caveat, because after further research, I found it in Saint Augustine, in his book called Confessions, okay, particular in his text called Confessions in book 11, to be precise, and probing further, because I wanted to look at what sources Augustine was using, I find it in the deep reflections of Plotinus's Aeneid 3. All that literature you can find and read, probably all of it for free online, if it's translated well. I recommend to make sure you have good translations. Now, time is recognized as a sequence of ontic events within the spatiotemporal framing of rational processing of the natural world. I don't think anybody could argue with that statement. Multi-locational coordinates, though, require signatures of space and time in order to be coherent, which is a component of truth, with experience, which is sensoria phenomena, and the very means of the process of perception. So space without time is an empty, dimensionless void of nothingness. Space requires temporal metrics in order to manifest a locus, thus deriving coordinate dimensions. You cannot define space phenomenologically, nor ontically, without an event, and every event involves change over time. Where temporality-defined events occur, a reference point is automatically generated, and dimensionality then is obtained. Okay. Now, all of this is happening in your mind without you thinking about it. And the reason I'm writing it out is because we should not try to think about it in the process, but we should think about it as something we're doing that we can take out and look at so that we know that this is a very complex process we're carrying out as we describe, if we're research scientists, the natural world. Furthermore, I would say that space-time allows for the negation of concepts like empty space and infinite time, because neither can be demonstrated independently or interdependently, since they would constitute the non-ontic, the non-real idea of nothingness. Nothingness is everything that is not real, right? So there's no sense ever even considering it. Problem appears on the ontic edge of the free will, though, which does not seem to inhabit space-time, unless I unbracket all the phenomenological events. When I do that, free will would only exist because of our sensoria, and such a dependent result would negate the concept ultimately of noumena, you know, the thing in itself, what is not phenomena. So I say no to that. If free will is true, I believe it is, it must be independent of the body and thus take its place in the soul. After all, my view that the soul is the means by which free will is an ontic event, as per the concept I generated called instance. Now, without that, I can't generate the concept of instance. So with this proposition, I realize we need further interlocution. It's an obvious thing because what I'm describing to you are just propositions, right? So perhaps the first antithesis to all this I mentioned to you would be, since soul is immaterial, it cannot perform a freely willed act in the physical world. So that's an easy straw man argument to knock down, because I find it quite unlikely that as a human, as an imagining agent, would require a physical outcome. Indeed, I can imagine cutting down trees to make a path to the summit of Mount Hermon, part of the Front Range near Monument, Colorado, without ever firing up my chainsaw. I can imagine that. So simply thinking about such an activity, not that I would ever do that, but even thinking of such an activity obviously doesn't instantiate the event, but it would be necessary for me to physically succeed, if I were to do that, in cutting all those trees, to have first contemplated the event with my faculties of reason. Besides, onic events need only be real. And that, of course, encompasses the physical universe. So I can argue that free will is indeed an ontic event of the soul. Yeah. Ultimately, the means to obtain authenticity in apprehending natural phenomena must rely on the intellect and must rely on the virtues. That's what I'm saying. Okay. So without both of those, not able to get anywhere. And to presuppose that the intellect is always working without working with the virtues of courage and wisdom and temperance and things like that would be an absurdity. Because then how would you know to trust even your own judgments? If you can't trust your own judgments, you can't believe. If you can't believe something, then you're not able to ever come to what is truth. And then you just fall into the complete fallacy of nihilism. Right? And that is like nothingness. Right? It does not exist. So research is never decided because the scientific worldview must be indeed perpetually humbled. Research is never fully decided. And it's humbled by, the scientific worldview is humbled by, the events that obviously obtain a priori to their study. Now, what do I mean by that? In biological systems, which is what some of us do for a living to study, life is, here's the term, already. It's already doing what it's doing. So if we're to interpret it, we don't need to change it, but we need to bring our faculties of intellect and virtue into it, apprehend it and pull it out to be able to examine it. Right? This is basically common sense, but it's not common sense until it's called common sense. Much like a lot of philosophy, I found. Now, that living systems are spatiotemporal is based on our sensorial insistence. They are so. And thence, all of our observations, hypotheses, experiments, results, evidence, and reason conclusions are based on assumption. Thus, it is both wise and courageous to proceed with a categorical imperative, a new one maybe, to absolutely avoid conclusions that are flawed because they are found to be either paralogisms or antinomies. Remember, paralogisms mean making a proposition beyond logic. And an antinomy is violating the basic law of logic. Saying something like, you can have A and not A at the same space and the same time, right? The excluded middle. That would be an antinomy. So as long as you keep paralogisms and antinomies out of your research, or if you find them, you negate them, you get rid of them, you're probably doing enough of a virtuous task toward understanding what you're studying. Okay. So, looks like we're about out of time here. I think I'm going to stop. So again, if this is something you didn't tune into Authentic Biochemistry for, I fully accept that. But this is free. And I'm delivering these lectures because I want to actually be a place of learning. And I think every once in a while, it's important. In fact, it's essential to get back down into the basic structure, not of the language, but of how the mind is working and how our senses